Hello, friends, and welcome again. It's been about a week since I've been able to be with you. Many demanding issues. But here we are on video commentary for A Treatise on White Magic, number 46. And we're on page 196, and we've been talking about the descent of energy from the monad. The first ray aspect, the second ray aspect, and the third ray aspect. The first ray descent is the will aspect of the monad to Atma, spiritual will, to the inner circle of petals in the egoic lotus, the will petals, and I also include the synthesis petal on will, the mental body, the head center in the etheric body, and the nervous system and brain. And there are other factors along the way, including the chakras of the astral plane. Then the love wisdom descent from the monad, you know, it's will, wisdom, and activity, goes from that aspect of the monad we call wisdom, or the love aspect, through buddhi, which is spiritual love, the intuition, the second circle of petals in the egoic lotus, but I don't want to leave out the love synthesis petal and the entire group of petals, which are the innermost surrounding the jewel, are made of buddhi. So naturally, there would be a connection here between that innermost circle of petals, the astral body, the heart center, the bloodstream, and we cannot forget the chakras of the astral body. Okay. And then finally, this is what we're dealing with today, the active intelligence descent from the monad, will, wisdom, and activity, or intelligence. So we're speaking of active intelligence, or the energy which animates the form aspect, the entire personality nature, and which creates forms in line with subjective purposes. Now, the ring pass knot of the third ray, think of Saturn, creates a circumscription in consciousness. And there is no form without circumscribed perception. Of course, if I carry it philosophically, I would call it circumscribed self-perception of the universal logos. But that may be another matter. Suffice it to say, the third aspect does draw the circle. It draws the circle, creating a restricted area, and that restricted area is form. So we're having a descent of active intelligence, or the energy which animates the form aspect, whatever we consider that form to be, as forms exist on the cosmic physical plane and far beyond in the stratification of cosmic and supercosmic and super-supercosmic planes, and on we go. There being, says the Tibetan, 10 dimensions in cosmos, and we're dealing with dimension number 1, if 1 is considered the lowest. Or is it dimension number 10, with 1 considered the highest? Okay, so, and which creates forms in line with the subjective purposes of the presiding intelligence, God or man, human or divine, and that's the whole thing about the divine plan. The forms which are created must be in line with the subjective purposes. Whether it's man or you know, the great number of superior intelligence. This particular line of energy also proceeds from the third aspect of the monad, and its line of contact is monad to manas, or spiritual intelligence, the higher mind, the abstract mind particularly, but also perhaps the higher mind on the higher two levels of the mental plane, with the abstract mind being on the first level. The third or outer circle of petals in the egoic lotus, those are the knowledge petals, but let us not forget the particular synthesis petal, which relates to the synthesis of knowledge. I don't know why he's leaving those out, maybe just to create a very clear line of descent that our minds can apprehend easily. The etheric body as a whole, interestingly, that body would be related to the third ray, and also to the third sign Gemini, and also to the third sign going backwards, or clockwise, Aquarius, which carries much of the third ray through it. So the etheric body as a whole, as it pervades the dense physical body, the throat center, and not the blood, but the cells of the body, the great multiplicity, the trillions of cells, the building blocks, the most circumscribed of the lives within the human organism. In little evolved man, as in the case of the second aspect and its unfoldment, the energy simply passes through the throat center and goes directly to the sacral center. That's the whole thing, you know. When we are not evolved, or much evolved, the energy from above is not retained. At first, in the higher centers. Later, it will be redirected to the higher centers in the discipleship and initiation process. So, straight from the throat center to the sacral center, interestingly, the sacral center being the home of the mental elemental. Maybe later, that elemental might rise to the throat center, but anyway, at first, it's the home of the mental elemental. Astral elemental is the solar plexus, and I suppose the physical elemental has to do with the base of the spine center, physical etheric, and thus brings into activity the generative processes and creative faculties. Will we be creative or procreative or both? Well, sometimes I think about, you know, is there really a choice there? You know, if a person is procreative, is he not necessarily creative? And then I just think of Johann Sebastian Bach with 20 children and extreme prolific creativity from the throat center, a true mathematical musical genius. So it's possible to be both or to do both. Anyway, it goes directly to the sacral center and thus brings into activity the generative processes and creative faculties, utilizing in the reproductive work and sex life of the race. Utilized in the reproductive work and sex life of the race. So forms are created for the incoming of souls. Later there is a tendency, and sometimes it is an escape, which Alice Bailey, by the way, did not make with three children. Avoiding of the responsibilities of procreation. But anyway, there's a tendency for the highly creative types focusing on the throat center to sometimes avoid those procreative responsibilities. I guess it depends on the karma and the signs and the rays and many, many factors, you know. One cannot make a judgment. Bach is an extreme example of a combination of both, but there are others who have contributed greatly to the creativity of the race and to the illumination of the race, working only through the throat centers and not involved in reproductivity at all. So one just is in peril if one tries to make some kind of generalization. He says, this is a broad and general outline of the three main streams of force or divine energy and their direction. Now notice he's using the word divine here and not spiritual, and divine energy comes from the monad and above. You know, there's no real above. It's a question of intensification. But the divine energy has a lot to do when we're thinking of the cosmic physical plane with the first two cosmic subplanes, the logoic and monadic, and below that comes the spiritual triad, which is going to include also the soul, even though it's located in the dense physical body of the planetary and solar logos. The relationship of the head center to the base of the spine, you know, purpose to will, that's how it's been described by DK, purpose to will, Uranus to Pluto, where lies the sleeping fire, will not be considered here, nor will the function of the solar plexus as a clearinghouse for the lower energies be touched upon, but elsewhere, of course, he does touch upon that whole process extensively, as it is related to the second initiation, solar plexus to heart, and, well, the base of the spine to the top of the head. It begins at the third degree and climaxes at the fifth degree, what may be operating at the sixth and seventh degree through a Maya Varupa. You know, I could not say that perhaps there are further stimulations. I'm anxious for the students simply to grasp the general idea and the skeleton for this teaching. You know, let's just say at least it is a start, and we are not overwhelmed by a plethora of detail. So, you know, Master DK is a master teacher, and he knows what the mind and consciousness of the average disciple can hold. And remember, this is, for all its wonder, an early book, and later more elaboration was undertaken. Although if we really look for the degree of elaboration in this book and look carefully, we find it is immense, actually. Every human being in the course of time works his way back on the path of return to one of the three major rays. And, you know, this is done, I would say, monadically, and relates perhaps to the three circles on the charts of the cosmic physical plane. I'll show you what I mean. See, if I go on here, I've showed this before. It's one of my theories at the moment, and I believe there's... Whoops. What have I done? All right, let's see if I can get back to where I belong. There it is. Well, here are three. And I believe the monad volatile essence, as it's called alchemically, is liberated into the sea of fire and finds its home in one of three circles, or here they're represented as triangles, rather than one of the seven circles or triangles. I mean, it may keep up its membership, so to speak, in one of the seven, but I have a feeling that ultimately they are monadic sub-rays when compared to the liberated monad in the Sea of Fire. Of course, the other possibility is that these first three are the most important, and that all of the rays of aspect, monads of aspect, are included within the third. In a sense, that's true. But then where do you get the sub-rays? Well, here is a very handy method of looking at the seven as sub-rays of the three, and that's basically what he says on page 176 of A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, if I'm interpreting it correctly. Each of the major types, the major three, has seven sub-rays. I wonder, you know, it's always possible to imagine a reference or to misquote it, and hopefully I'm not doing too much of that, but every once in a while I'm shocked by one of my own misquotes. inquiry might naturally arise as to whether the egoic ray is necessarily one of the major three rays, and if initiates and masters are not to be found on some of the rays of mind, the minor four. And here, you know, well, the language is complex, because a little bit later he talks about the ninefold choice of rays for the ego. But the egoic ray, and, you know, I sometimes call with all capitals the monadic ray the egoic ray. The egoic ray can always be one of the seven, but we need to remember the bulk of the monads are on the second ray. Okay. The dragon of wisdom. After the third initiation, here it is. After the third initiation, all human beings find themselves on their monadic ray, on one of the three major rays, and the facts that masters are found on all of the rays is due to the following two factors. Now we're dealing with the monadic ray, and note here, each of the major rays has its subrays which correspond to all the seven. And that's the one that I'm really quoting here. There are seven subrays to the monad, and I'm not just talking about the ray of the soul being the subray. I'm talking about something that's operating on the monadic plane itself. So that's the reference that takes me to consider, or at least opens the possibility that one of these, each of these three, can have a lower outpost through any one of these seven here. And a pure type, you know, one, and then triad of Atma and so forth, would be the absolutely pure monadic ray of the destroyer, which Master DK says we couldn't really tolerate at this time as a race. It would be just too much for us. Okay, excuse me. So he works his way back on the path of return on one of the major three rays. But let's remember also that on the way of higher evolution, all seven monadic rays show up. And why should that be? It's very interesting. You know, he tells us that, fifth ray people, that is, those who have their monads on the fifth ray, often take the path of magnetic work, and that the path of the planetary logoi is related to the third ray in the training department, and that the masters of the wisdom are the ones that tread the ray path rather than the lords of compassion. The rays have something to do, at least, with the way one treads the way of higher evolution. Obviously, on the ray path, all seven types are needed, because there are seven rays, and they have to be the monadic essence has to identify as one of those seven streams on that path. Well, I don't want to go too far afield, but let's just say that every human being in the course of time works his way back on the path of return to one of the three major rays, and remember that the third ray contains the rays of attribute, rays of attributes, the four of them. Okay, so this is all done monadically. And I've shown you the chart where the three hover above the seven. So you have the possibility of any one of the seven subrays for the major monadic ray. And I think he gives us a hint there. You know, that which is the monadic ray can be considered the major ray, but there's also, I think, at least, a major monadic ray and a minor monadic ray. Well, anyway, all have eventually to express intelligent creative activity, to be animated by divine love, and to bring into functioning activity the will as it works out divine purpose and the plan. But even in greater beings, the emphasis is not equal. you're going to have solar logoi who emphasize the first ray, the second, the third, or whatever. And even seven different colors of stars appear, the astronomers tell us. So this question of ray differentiation does go far beyond the stage of human development. Probably even the galaxies themselves carry a certain ray from an original universal septonate, the source of which we cannot possibly know, and or the height of which, or the plane of which we cannot possibly know, probably on the very highest planes of the universe, which are not even pictured at all in our books. But we can extrapolate, you know, and think about, by analogy, where that super divine septonate can be found. Okay, now moving on. The first center, oh, by the way, where did I begin? I think it was 196, okay. I'm always forgetting that by the end, and then I have to go on that hunt, but maybe I can, you know, press the area above my nose the way Master Moria says to do when you want to remember something, press the bridge of your nose. Pretty practical, isn't it? So maybe I'll remember. Okay. The first center which the aspirant seeks consciously to energize and on which he concentrates during the early stages of his novitiate is the heart center. Now, we're all in the early stages. There's no question about it. You know, we're not initiates of any standing here deep within the ashram. You know, these are early days, relatively speaking. The heart center. And we do note that even though it is the solar plexus, for the first initiation, the sacral center is very important and its transference to the throat center, but the heart center is definitely stimulated. I think at every initiation, the heart center is stimulated. You know, chakras unfold gradually. And we certainly know at the fourth degree, it's the major chakra to be stimulated. So, but at this first initiation, which we call the birth of the Christ in the heart, there is a necessary heart stimulation. What does it yield when we concentrate on the heart? He has to learn to be group conscious, be sensitive to group ideals, and to be inclusive in his plans and concepts. Notice that word, inclusive or inclusivity. It has a lot to do with the second ray, although any member of the hierarchy being generally under the second ray impress that conditions hierarchy will be to a degree inclusive. So group conscious, you know, response to group vibration on the second subplane of the mental plane, sensitive to group ideals, the higher type of idealism of the soul. The soul has idealism, the monad has idealism, every great being has idealism. Sometimes because it's associated with the second, a sixth ray, we want to put it aside, you know, as if it's not really important. But idealism is that which allows you to reach into uncharted territory, you know, and faith being the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And it's a way to the higher light, since DK tells us really the esoteric version of that saying is that light is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things unseen. Anyway, he has to learn to love collectively and purely and not be actuated by personality attraction and the motive of reward. So these are all factors which... what can we say here? That the awakened heart center will see, heart center will see the development of these virtues. Group consciousness, inclusivity, collective love, pure love, and, the letting go of personality attractions, which are so, you know, prominent throughout the history of humanity and in the Fourth Kingdom and, you know, in those who are far from awakening to their higher potentials, the personality attractions rule the day, and not so much that discerning understanding of soul attraction. Until there is this awakening in the heart, remember, it's a gradual process. The heart center doesn't wake up, you know, all at once. And over, you know, really millions of years, it's awakening. He cannot be trusted to wield the creative powers of the throat center. Now, that's very interesting. The throat center so often is associated with that which is rather lower than the heart center. But if we turn to page 170 of a treatise on cosmic fire, we will see that the heart center gets activated in the line of ascent before the throat center does. So, you know, here we find heart center is here, and only later, when there's mental control, does the throat center awaken, but the heart center is there even before that. So the heart center is persistent, and there it is, persistent, as it leads to the Buddhic plane, all the way important, even for spiritual man, to the fifth initiation. Remembering, of course, if you're going to take the fourth initiation, you really are concentrating upon the heart center, with its fourfoldness, even anatomically, the four and four. So until there is at least this initial awakening in the heart, he cannot be trusted to wield the creative powers of the throat center, for they would be subordinated to self-aggrandizement and ambitions of various kinds. So we need rightly motivated creativity, and this requires heart center awakening. To what extent, we don't know, because there are probably all kinds of technicalities about the anatomy of the heart center or any center, and the manner in which it awakens and its different parts and interactions, the sort of metaphysiology of the chakras, we might call it. Here it should be noted that none of these unfoldments can ever be approached from the standpoint of complete static passivity, or from the angle of an entirely new undertaking. Okay. We are in process of evolution, and certain aspects of the four centers from long ago, really, are already awakened and function in relation to the form aspect, but are not yet expressing soul qualities. Now, notice this phrase, certain aspects of the four centers. Now, maybe they are petals, maybe they are aspects of the jewel within each one of those centers. We don't know. He's being general here about these aspects. But we do know that there are different parts in the anatomy and physiology, metaphysiology of the centers, which awaken at different times and come into various degrees of stimulation at different times. And, you know, that's some of the heavy fifth ray detail that will have to come to us at the right time. So certain aspects of our four centers are already awakened and functioning in relation to the form aspect. So certain aspects of a chakra apply to the form, and certain aspects of a chakra apply to the soul. So let's put that down. Aspects of a chakra apply to the form, and certain aspects to the soul, or varying intensities of the aspects, apply to the form or soul. Obviously, the more intensely stimulated the chakra is, the more it will be able to be used for soul purposes. But of course, there has to be a general quieting down of the lower chakras, which can still be used for soul purposes, so that they don't become the dominant factor over the higher chakras. Okay, we have behind us a long and fruitful past. Even the monad does. The monad has its own evolution before it came to this planet and began its descending and ascending arc, its pilgrimage. So what is the history of the monad? DK hints at it. It's not just a tabula rasa, you know, it's not just a blank spirit waiting to be somehow fulfilled from below. It has its own great journey through the universe before it came to this point. About those things we cannot know, you know, what is our monadic origin and so forth, except to say that obviously we came from and are parts of the universal logos. So we have behind us a long and fruitful past. We are none of us purely selfish or separative. Human society is now cohesive and interdependent. Humanity as a whole has already done much in bringing the heart center into partial activity and in awakening some of the more important aspects of the throat center. See this word aspect, so much is hidden behind the word aspects. This is talking about the anatomy and metaphysiology of the various centers. He's not going into detail. So we all have this experience behind us, and we are to different extents awakened. And the master, when he decides that he can expend the energy to work with us, and we thus become an accepted disciple, is understanding something of this history and the degree of present unfoldment, and therefore what the next step has to be. I suppose, you know, it's really necessary to for the river of forgetfulness to offer its drink to us. Otherwise, we would become quite confused if we were presented with the various recollections of where we've been and what we've done. I mean, selectively and for a particular purpose, past lives have to be remembered, but I often use the analogy, if I'm playing the role of King Lear in Shakespeare, I don't want to remember my lines from Macbeth and so forth. You know, I want to concentrate on the immediate requirement. So a recollection has to cease, but memory ingrained in us with the lessons learned must rule. The problem with many aspirants today is that of the solar plexus, for it is wide open. When DK was analyzing one of his early disciples, the very first disciple that was written about, who was a third-ray soul but a sixth-ray personality and a sixth-ray astral, you'll notice that it was the solar plexus that was wide open, you know, something 75% open, something like that, and the Ajna Center was not much open, maybe just 15%. But the solar plexus was the most open of all, and that's fairly characteristic of the kinds of disciples that would come to Master DK for training at this period of history. It's wide open, actively functioning, and almost fully awakened. I wonder, no, I won't go there. Anyway, you look it up. He was an Englishman and a teacher in theosophy and very strongly mental, but also very devoted and aspirational with his double sixth ray. The work of transmutation is, however, going on simultaneously, leading, as one might and naturally suppose, to a good deal of difficulty and chaotic conditions. We talk about these words, transmutation, transformation, transfiguration. We think, well, it's just a stage. I'm passing through that piece of cake. But there are many disharmonious conditions, which have to be harmonized, lived through and harmonized. So anyway, the solar plexus is often the issue, and every one of us should not imagine that we have somehow passed through all the difficulties incident to it. Look at Alice Bailey, who accomplished so much for humanity and probably, you know, ended her incarnation, certainly I would say as an initiate of the third degree. That much, I would say, a certainty. I don't know more. But she had her issues with the solar plexus, for sure. And if you read her unfinished autobiography, you will see that there was a lot of sixth ray legacy, I would say, solar plexus functioning in the earlier part of her life, when she was quite an inspiring preacher rather than the teacher. Okay, so lots of chaotic conditions are possible here in this work of increasing the vibration and purifying transmutation. The heart center is also beginning to vibrate, but is not yet awakened. This is the condition for the average aspirant. Now, obviously, when the second initiation is taken, that heart center has to be fairly awakened, because there's a transference going on from the solar plexus to the heart, and the astral body has to begin to become the vehicle of love rather than of desire. The throat center is frequently prematurely awakened. That's kind of interesting, you know, because it means that people know more than they can do. Or should we say know about more? Because theoretically. Okay, know about, how about I get this correct, more than they can do. And, you know, we're living in Aryan times, and the mental stimulation is very great. And the very first factor is to get the sex life under control, and that will mean a rising of the energy and greater creativity. So sometimes the mental body is way ahead of the possibility of being supported correctly by the desire body. Okay, so though the throat center is frequently prematurely awakened, you see many of these cases, through the transfer of energy from the sacral center. This is due to several causes, sometimes to spiritual purpose. Could be the ray, you know, involved. If, you know, if the monad or soul's on the third ray or fifth ray, this kind of awakening can come fast. But more frequently, to the negation of the normal sex life, owing to the economic conditions or to lack of physical vitality, which predisposes to celibacy, you know, and thus the rising of the energy before it should rise. So there's a healthy balance that is meant to take place. And if under economics and its third ray, there is a blocking of the, or negation of the normal sex life, there's going to be a premature rising of that energy before the desire body really knows what to do with it. Anyway. This lack of vital force is, in its turn, due to many factors, but primarily to a long heredity producing a degeneracy of the physical body. I guess in certain groups and races and countries this has been going on, and maybe even the karmic tendencies of the individual conducing to a degeneracy of the physical body, or to the enforced celibacy of past lives. This enforced celibacy was very often the result of monasticism and living of the mystical life. So the solar plexus is getting all the energy there. And the individual is not allowed to express in a normal way. And the result is that we get an unbalanced chakric interrelation, And I think DK said that the people that are working with him and his groups have had one or two monastic lives, and in those lives there was, whether it's through Buddhism or Christianity, a kind of enforced celibacy with the warping effect upon the personality and nature. So there will possibly be a warping effect upon the personality and nature and imbalance. We've all seen warps in wood, and it can be artistically interesting, but sometimes quite ugly, and that's a distortion. So we are the product very much karmically of what we've been living through, and we're born with those tendencies. When this creative awakening finds expression through any of the arts, literature, painting, music, or in group organization or executive work, there is no harm wrought, for the energy found finds a normal, creative outlet. And many artists are at this stage when there is a big transference from the sacral center to the solar plexus. Not an entire transference. There's a lot of battles going on, even in the news today. The creative field is filled with sacral excess, even though there's a huge creativity. So these kind of developments go on over many lives until a balance is achieved and the dominance of the higher center without necessarily negating the right expression of the lower center. I sometimes, look at someone like Meryl Streep, a great actress. Who knows when you might listen to this? It could be long, long ahead, but I think she has six children, and almost every movie she touches is a wonderful portrayal. Again, a bit like Bach in that respect. So these points should be remembered by the aspirant. He is facing a most complex problem. He has no idea really of the complexity, but the master who can see within has a strong idea of the complexity and the difficulty of unraveling it and really solving it. He enters blindly in, blindly, there it is, into a situation which is the result of a long evolutionary process and to which he has not the key. He is impelled, he is, whoops, sorry, he is impelled by the soul energy within himself, but does not really know his condition or its antecedents. Especially in the early stages and prior to the first initiation, so one can certainly be an aspirant prior to the first initiation. Is this the case? Especially in the early stages and prior to the first initiation, this is the case. And he has no knowledge of the history of the past nor any prevision as to the future. He just knows there's something better, higher, more spiritual that he wants. He has simply to take his equipment and his opportunity and do the best he can, guided by the age-old rules of Raja Yoga and the light of his own soul. And later, later, as in the new esoteric schools, he will learn the methods of past life retrieval as it is deemed necessary or helpful. I mean, it's not all past lives that would be useful to us to examine, but there are certain ones that probably have scandic connections with our present condition, depending on the astrology and the rays. Not all of our past karma and tendencies is coming through in every life. Probably certain of those tendencies come through in some lives and certain other tendencies in others. At least that's my impression. As the heart center is awakened and the throat center swings into creative work, that's a sort of the blending of the generic second and third rays, a definite relation is set up and there is an interplay of energy between the two. It's kind of a, you know, Mercury is involved there, Venus and Jupiter, I would say, Saturn too. This activity in its turn brings about a response from that aspect. There's that word again of the thousand-petaled lotus, a synthetic lotus, through which the energy always animating the heart and throat center normally passes. So, oh, you know, you can imagine the intricacy of these energy relations occurring in the bioelectric, etheric field. You know, we don't even know the anatomy, true anatomy of the head center. There's lots of hints here and there. And as I said, when DK was asked directly about this by the disciple FCD, he kind of demurred and basically said, well, it's a very complex and occult subject and not much is given out at this time. Maybe in some of the Hindu books, there is more given out in a different system and we would have to correlate it properly. So heart and throat together, it, you know, this happens through, let's see, wait a second. As the process of soul infusion, SL, well, okay, SLINF, as the process of soul infusion occurs, because it is the is the third aspect which must be infused by the second, and so the heart center representing the second aspect of divinity and the throat center representing the third aspect of divinity will both be involved. Okay, so this responsive activity and interaction brings about two results, and these should be most carefully noted. So now, the head center, the great head center, is now involved with the growth and stimulation of the throat center and heart center. Okay, so what happens here? An interplay of energy between the two, heart and throat, and then the head. Now, you know, these are monadically considered the three major centers. The third ray monads generically working through the throat center, second ray through the heart, first ray through the head. Of course, they all work through the head because the head has, in a way, everything in it, all the rays, and has the prototypes of all the other more normally considered centers. First, the light in the head makes its appearance. A sparking, if I might so express it, is set up between the higher positive overshadowing energy, as it is centralized within the form of the thousand-petaled lotus, and we might call this soul energy, and ruled in this case by Vulcan, and maybe later by Uranus, and the steadily heightening vibration of the heart and throat centers, or lotuses. So, you know, we have planetary interplay, or the way that man has appropriated the planetary energies are interplaying here. These two lower centers in their turn are responding to the energies being lifted and raised from the centers below the diaphragm. So a dual stimulation is occurring for the heart center and the throat center. And just, you know, we always have to watch, where is the stimulation coming when it's coming from above? Where is it coming from when it's coming from below? So some of these intermediate centers are receiving from both areas. Now, what else? So the first thing is the light in the head is making its appearance because of the interplay, because of the interplay of these centers. Okay. Secondly, the center between the eyebrows also begins to make its presence felt. And not just in the personal sense, you know. There's a way in which the center between the eyebrows is a very personal chakra, directing the integrating but non-spiritualized personality. And there are ways in which the higher aspects of this center awakening connect with the spiritual triad, for instance. So again, you know, there are different aspects to the chakras connecting with different aspects of our energy system. Okay, so the center between the eyebrows begins to make its presence felt, and this significant two-petaled lotus begins to vibrate. It really, you know, it's what can I say? It's actually 96 petals are involved, and the number 98 becomes significant, and even the number 100. And why would that be? Well, it's a two-petaled lotus, but each of the two petals is dual. You know, one being of the quality blue and violet, and the other being of the quality yellow and rose. So the four is added to the 96, and we get the 100. And it's a great integrating center. So whenever you have a number like 1, 10, 100, etc., signifies integration. So it symbolized the work of at oneing the soul and the body. So let's just say all part of the integrative process. The subjective and the objective, and true subjectivity we know is not the astral body, not the mental body, it is the soul. Those other bodies I just mentioned are subtle, but they're not subjective. That's the distinction that Master DK seems to use. In some occult books, it is called the lotus with the 96 petals, but this is only a differentiation dealing with the energies focused in the two petals. So from 2 to 4 to 96. It will be noticed that the sum total of the four petals in the centers, excluding the two head centers, amount in all to 48 petals. Now, what do we got there? So let's see. The four of the base of spine center, plus the six of the sacral center, plus the 10 of the solar plexus center, plus the 12 of the heart center, and plus the 16 of the throat center. Let's see, so that's 10, 10, 20, 32, and 16, 48. Okay, equals 48. And that's half of 96. So that shows a numerical relationship there between the supervising asana center, which directs so much energy, hence the number 100, as I said, seems significant, and the 48 below. These energies and their two aspects of physical and vital energy and soul qualities make up the 96 aspects or vibrations of the two petals of the ajna eyebrow center. So he differentiates here, and this is very interesting. Let's see. Differentiates between the physical tendencies of the 48 and the soul tendencies of the 48. And then relates these tendencies to the 96 of the ajna center. And we remember, you know, this ajna center is the center of choice. So basically a person is choosing between the generic third aspect and the more divine, at this time, second aspect. And, you know, it's right there, ruled by Libra, in a way, where choice is made about the left-hand path and the right-hand path. And the left-hand path will be the path of matter and constriction and binding. And the right-hand path will be the path of liberation. So the numbers do support all the psychology that we're dealing with, spiritual psychology. It must be remembered also that the word petal only symbolizes an expression of force and its apparent effect in matter. The real energy seems to form a petal-like structure, but is obviously not a petal. But we talk about it that way because it's convenient and we can bring many energies together under one name. So I find this most interesting, don't you, that these 48, the 48 petals, these energies in their two aspects, that's something I had overlooked before, of physical vital energy and soul qualities make up the 96 aspects or vibrations of the two petals in the ajna or eyebrow center. And, you know, which shall it be? As I say, there is a blue and violet side to this, and also a yellow and rose, or rose and yellow, and I forget which is above, and which shall be associated with the vitality, and which shall be associated with the soul qualities. And I think it's actually the rose. Well, it seems to me it's the rose and yellow that would be associated with the soul qualities, especially since physical vital energy is associated with the etheric body and its violet nature. And then sometimes, you know, with blue, it's associated astrally because of the blue waters of the astral plane, so to speak. There's something there a little more to be disentangled, but each one of these petals, the major two, has one or other of those leanings. And I wouldn't be surprised if the petals that are found on the right-hand side lean more, and near the right eye, lean more towards the soul, and on the left-hand side more towards the physical and vital energy. Huh. Mm-hmm. It gets pretty intricate, doesn't it? Well, look, I'll tell you what. Let's this be the end of a treatise on white magic. Webinar. A video commentary, number 46 from page 196, I remember, see, to page 199. And when we begin again, beginning of a treatise on white magic, video commentary, number 47, and we'll start at page 199, where we are right now, and go to what? Well, we'll see. You know, we never know. 3, 4, 5 pages, that's about all that is possible. And going back here, we'll just fill in this number, 199. Quite an amazing book, friends, isn't it? And if we could really correlate all this information, we would have both the overview and the intricate view. Both are presented here, and also that which is most essential for the disciple. It's all presented here. So we are being given the overview and the detailed view. And somehow, you know, in this foundational book, we have to put these two things together. And it's the forest and the trees, isn't it? You know, some students get lost in the trees. They can't see the forest. And other people just seeing the forest, and the individual trees are not of interest. So we need to do both, do we not? All right, we'll move on. I always feel I'm leaving something behind, and I know I am. This thing about the two different aspects of the center is very, very interesting, and how it's the ajna correlating and related to the two aspects of the 48 petals. So every chakra is going to have that vital aspect to it, and every chakra will have a soul potentiality, and probably a bit later in the game, the soul potentiality is that which emerges. Okay, friends, many blessings. We'll see you later for number 47.